T.S. Eliot called Hamlet interesting, but not quite art. Centuries later, the Prince of Denmark continues to invite debate and reinterpretation. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Engelsberg Ideas, and to explore Hamlet and its rich critical history, I'm joined by Emma Smith, Professor of Shakespeare Studies at the University of Oxford, and Paul Lay, EI's Senior Editor. So, Emma, let's start with the story itself. How does Shakespeare's Hamlet differ from earlier versions of the Hamlet story?
It's a great question, and it brings us immediately to a gap in the history. There are always gaps in what we know about Shakespeare. There was clearly a pre-Hamlet play, probably called Hamlet, which is in some now lost relation to the play as it's come down to us. So that source is difficult to articulate, but maybe we'll come to talk about it more later. The immediate extant source is a historical-ish story, a Danish story from the text called Saxo Grammaticus, which came to Shakespeare's awareness, I think, via French, via the work of Belforest. And there are various differences that are quite characteristic of the way Shakespeare uses his sources. One, I think, usefully has been described by Stephen Greenblatt, brilliant critic and writer about Renaissance texts, as Shakespeare's strategic opacity. And by that, Greenblatt means he takes texts where motive and causation are quite clear, and in the rewriting of them, Shakespeare complicates those narrative elements. And that's really true of Hamlet, isn't it? So lots of the questions we ask about the play, is Hamlet really mad? How far was Gertrude implicated in the murder of her husband? These are all clarified in Shakespeare's source. So it's the ambiguity that Shakespeare deliberately puts into the play. So he takes a story which is a bit more straightforward and complicates and interiorizes it, I think.
How does that, those problems of causation and structure, how does Hamlet differ from Shakespeare's earlier plays? I'm particularly thinking of the history plays in the way they relate to the sources.
I think it's useful to see Hamlet as a belated history play. It comes at the very end of the 1590s into 1600. And that's the point at which the Privy Council have made the writing of fictions based on English history much more difficult, much more subject to censorship. And it marks the end of Shakespeare's interest in that particular form with Henry V in 1599. But Hamlet picks up loads of the concerns of the history play, most especially the sense of sons inheriting from overpowerful fathers, the sense that the heir to the throne or the son of the powerful king can never quite live up to what's expected of them or struggles to find their place. I mean, that's, as I describe that, that may sound to some people like the story of Henry IV, that Hamlet is a sort of grown-up or more soured Prince Hal, and perhaps Hamlet would have been better if he'd had a Falstaff figure to sort of jolly him through this difficult Prince of Wales-ish period. So what Shakespeare does, though, with medieval history is, I think, to have much more of an eye to an ongoing historical shape. So history plays are interesting structurally because their ending is in some sense always provisional, explicitly if you have multiple parts of a historical sequence, but implicitly because people know that the history continues. But Hamlet sort of takes up that legacy, that narrative legacy, in a way which is much more extremely and unequivocally end-stopped. That's to say, the play not only ends with deaths, with multiple deaths, but really it's all about death. And so it operates within the closure and the inevitability of tragedy in a way that I think Shakespeare doesn't quite do in the history plays.
Yes, and the parallels are interesting, aren't they? That Henry V, Prince Hal, has a kind of full figure, also stages a play within a play to reveal something to himself or to other characters. But then, as you say, there's never really a sense with Hal that you always feel like Hal knows that he's going to transform at some point into something else, that he's kind of looking forward, whereas Hamlet seems always to be looking back.
That's so interesting. I think you're absolutely right that Hamlet's preoccupation is the rearview mirror, is looking backwards. It's such a good comparison. Yeah, you're absolutely right, that there is a redemptive arc to the Henry IV plays, which is taking us towards Agincourt and Henry V's sort of apotheosis as an English hero. And the play within the play, I hadn't sort of thought about that as a parallel, but it's a really good one. And you're absolutely right that the play within the play is trying to reveal something which will happen in the future. It's proleptic in that way, whereas the Mousetrap and the work the Mousetrap is doing for Hamlet in his play is backward-looking, is trying to understand what happened in the past. It's one of the reasons I think Hamlet has been so interestingly cited and riffed on by detective fiction, because that's another backward-looking, you know, what was it that happened in the past and how can we sort of come to terms with it? So I do think you're right that Hamlet is, despite or perhaps because of the way in which it's been seen to anticipate modernity, it's always been seen or long been seen as a play which has a period long, long after its own conception and first performances in its sights that it already somehow knows about the ennui and agonies of modernity. Nevertheless, it is also really backward looking and preoccupied with the past.
You know, we can talk in a bit about some of the classical models and the Christian models and the various elements of intellectual archaeology that are in the play. But there's another parallel that strikes me about Hamlet in terms of the kind of hero that he is. I always think of Aeneas in the Aeneid. Now, that's obviously interpreted in general as the great future poem of the Rome that is to be. It anticipates the kind of grand historical narrative that culminates with Augustus at the top of a new imperial system. But actually, if you read the poem and the Aeneid, Aeneas for about half the poem, until he goes into the underworld, until he confronts death in a kind of real, deep way, is constantly looking back. He's visited by ghosts of his father. He's constantly confronted with the Trojan past. So in Carthage, he sees the great kind of images of the Trojan Wars, and that's when he says, "Sunt lacrimae rerum." And he's constantly looking back, until he suddenly looks forward, and he becomes actually a very different character in the latter half of the play. So I think that's interesting about history and drama, where you have some heroes who are aware of their history and then kind of grasp the metal, as it were, and are conscious of doing so, whereas Hamlet is always sort of stuck. And I think that's why people think of him as this great self-conscious figure. He's stuck, but you know, then the plot takes him in other directions. So it is a revenge tragedy. What's the nature of Hamlet's kind of special role and mission? And how is Shakespeare's Hamlet different from the kind of typical revenge tragedy models that were available to Shakespeare?
I'm so interested in what you've just said about the Aeneid. I mean, not least because the speeches of the players who come to Elsinore and who then put on the Mousetrap are so, you know, they're engaged with a Trojan play that's often thought to be inspired or influenced by Christopher Marlowe and Thomas Nashe's play Dido, Queen of Carthage. But clearly, the Aeneid is being directly alluded to and therefore activating some of those parallels that you've brought out. I think that's a really interesting phenomenon, and it has a very interesting role, doesn't it, on how far Hamlet is or understands himself to be a modern hero character with agency and how far he is enacting a narrative which has been written for him to some extent, or in which he is a sort of slightly passive participant. And the revenge tragedy genre, I think, does relate to that, that revenge is a strong narrative form which commits those who have been wronged, usually by the murder of somebody close to them, commits them to acts of revenge, which in turn commit the plot to eliminating them. So revenge is both a moral imperative and a narrative imperative, but it's also something which has to be punished by the death of the revenger. So it's a double bind, really. And Hamlet has often been understood to be very distinct from the revenge tragedy tradition, which we most prominently, I guess, associate with Thomas Kyd's play, The Spanish Tragedy. And the standard story about Hamlet is that it intellectualizes what was a very savage and bloody genre, a genre much more interested in murders than in soliloquies or contemplations or reflection, and that Hamlet transforms that. And to an extent, that's true, but Hamlet has its own sort of body count, doesn't it? And there are times when Hamlet himself is really trying on quite self-consciously the mantle of the revenger. 'Tis now the very witching hour of night, and I could drink hot blood. I mean, that's a revenge tragedy cliche, almost, as if he's trying to talk himself or perform himself into that role. So I think Hamlet the play both distances itself from the tradition of revenge tragedy and sort of shamelessly borrows from its crowd-pleasing powers. And it's interesting to think about how you introduced the term of Hamlet as a hero, and I wondered whether, I mean, in some ways, he's obviously a tragic hero. Is he heroic? Is he heroic in the Virgilian sense? But the revenge tragedy protagonist by the time of Hamlet is actually rather an ambivalent figure that in seeking to repay or requite a moral debt, they become themselves the violent and savage creature that they wanted to banish. And Hamlet himself is not entirely immune to that moral crossover, that he becomes morally sullied by the task he has to undertake.
Yeah, I do think of him as a hero, but he's such a peculiar kind of hero. And there are parallels in later literature where you can see distinctively like Hamletian types. It's a parallel that's probably not made often, but Frodo in Lord of the Rings, I think of as a kind of someone who is more self-conscious of his task than other characters, and yet is kind of an ambivalent hero. He sort of is driven by action as much as driving it. Peter O'Toole's Lawrence of Arabia is that kind of ambivalent hero who is highly self-conscious of what he's doing and occasionally racked with doubt and guilt. But just to return to the play, I think he's a peculiar hero, but some of the most admirable moments where Hamlet, I think, comes across as very likable are when he's interacting with the players. I think it's a really beautiful moment.
Hamlet is clearly absolutely energised and delighted by the players. And that's interesting. The Lawrence of Arabia parallel you just made is about another isolated figure, isolated for all kinds of cultural as well as sort of psychological reasons. Whereas Frodo is, to some extent, isolated in company, but the company is really important there. And I think Shakespeare, in writing Hamlet, is the first tragedy. He writes a couple of early tragedies early in his career, Romeo and Juliet and Titus. But then through the 1590s, as we've been discussing, he writes plays based on English history plays. And he also writes comedies. We tend to think about comedies really in terms of being funny or whatever. But what they are is busy social plays. They're about people who get to understand themselves and their world better through dialogue and through community rather than through isolation. And it sometimes feels to me that Hamlet, coming out of that period, is a little bit unclear about whether Hamlet is isolated or not, or whether he most experiences, understands himself in isolation or in moments of self-reflection or in moments of dialogue. And I think the bit you've just picked out about the players is a little vestige of the play, which is more like a comedy. Again, which is not to say I think it's funny, but that it is about the energy and life-affirmingness, which isn't something that we get explicitly in Hamlet a lot, of being together and doing something together. That's what Hamlet sees in the players, I think. So I agree that it's a moment of warmth and comradeship. It's the opposite of the curdled friendship with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who have been co-opted by Claudius. And perhaps it's a little bit more like the relationship with Horatio, who's an interesting character, I think, in the play, in that he is resolutely there. Is he only there really to give the final elegy on Hamlet, Goodnight, Sweet Prince? Or does he present a sort of alternative that Hamlet can't quite engage with, which is that you're not actually as alone with all this as you seem to think you are? You've actually got a very loyal friend who is waiting to be taken into your confidence.
Emma, I'm really interested in the points both you and Alistair have made about the historical context of this. It's an irony that censors often unwittingly free people up. And so this move away from the English history plays with characters who I presume, I mean, this is a big question, I suppose, would be familiar with the audience and they would know or have some sense of the narrative. He's freed up with Hamlet being in a foreign land, being an unfamiliar figure, to play with that perhaps a little bit more. And correct me if I'm wrong here on chronology, but I think it's quite close to the writing of Julius Caesar, Hamlet. It precedes him. And there's that bit that Polonius says when the actors are there. He talks about his university past and, you know, Brutus killed me. But there's also a piece of Brutus, says a few lines that Brutus talks about, that seems to me, this might be a bit pretentious, but seems to anticipate Hamlet's state of mind. He says something like, between the acting of a dreadful thing and the first motion, all the interim is like a phantasm or hideous dream. And that seems to be, to me at least, some kind of way in to the state of mind of Hamlet.
Yeah, that's really great, Paul. And I think if we can't be pretentious talking about Hamlet, I mean, when could we ever be pretentious? So I mean, let's allow ourselves that at least. I was just thinking as you were talking, a couple of things there, as you were talking about the difference with the history plays. I don't know whether in viewing Hamlet in relation to those other plays, it might not look actually rather similar. We've got a young sort of dispossessed man, we've got challengers to the throne, we've got a king on the throne who has various vulnerabilities and so on. So it might have seemed more similar, but you're absolutely right that censorship is creative and often produces a new direction and a new work. And most chronologies, as you say, would put Julius Caesar, a turn to Roman history, as one of Shakespeare's immediate responses to the ban, effective ban on the writing of English history. And that bit of Brutus's that you picked out, I think, is a brilliant presage for Hamlet. You know, Brutus is, I mean, the thing about the two plays is that Brutus is sort of Claudius. You know, he's the murderer. And there is a way in which Claudius in our play has moments where suddenly the emphasis is on him, and there's a different play that could in the wings. We know famously from Stoppard about Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. You know, what do you do with characters, sidelined characters, and how do they become the centre of an alternative play? Well, you could do something quite similar with Claudius, and it would draw, I think, a lot on the position in which Brutus finds himself in Julius Caesar. Polonius's explicit reference to that is great, isn't it? That it almost certainly establishes Polonius, the Polonius actor, as somebody, an older man who has a talent for lying still in the middle of the play, pretending to be dead. Because just as Caesar, the corpse of Caesar is on stage, while Brutus and then famously Mark Antony, friends, Romans and countrymen, have their great rhetorical sparring match across it, so too Polonius is unceremoniously sort of lugged about, isn't he, as a corpse after Hamlet inadvertently stabs him in Gertrude's chamber.
And there seems to me, I mean, I'm certainly not the first person to observe this, but there's an uncertainty and an instability about both the play, the context and the central character, I think. And this is even reflected, I suppose, in the opening words, you know, who's there? And yeah. I just wondered, again, referring to this historical moment, this actual point, we're on this idea of the empirical, of trying to, you know, this idea of sensory perception, what can we know about the world, what can we be certain of? But in raising that question, we then have to consider uncertainty. And I just wonder what the historical context is there, because I think there's a phrase by Coleridge where he talks about Hamlet being paralysed by excess thought or paralysed by excess of thought. It's almost as though this new philosophy, this new idea of empiricism, raises as many uncertainties as it resolves.
Yes, and that it's deeply discomforting. You know, it takes away the comforts of certainty, and it's a very difficult world to be in, which I suppose is one of the things that you're right, we can historicise to the very end of the 16th into the 17th century, and we can see as one of the ongoing relevances of the play that we have seemed perhaps ever since that time to be on the brink of new uncertainties. Mm. And therefore the play has seemed to be perennially relevant. I think one of the factors is the very history play context, which is the end of the reign of Queen Elizabeth. So the great uncertainty in immediate terms is who is going to take over after the now, you know, well into her 60s, Queen Elizabeth dies. She has not named any successor. And theatre is one of the ways that's absolutely connected with the banning of English history, because it's clear that this is one of the ways that the culture is exploring different models of succession, transfer of power, regime change, and so on.
Yeah, that must have been absolutely central.
Yeah, so we've got a kind of end of an era feeling about this, end of the century, you know, kind of fin de siècle moment as well. And we have got these new theories which are very, very new for Shakespeare coming in. Perhaps especially we should mention the French philosopher Michel de Montaigne. One of the suggestions, and I think it's a very convincing one, about the differences between the extant texts of Hamlet is the influence of Montaigne. So just as a recap, we've got a quarto edition, so they're single plays or pamphlet editions, in 1603, so at the very end of Elizabeth's reign, and in 1604, the start of James I's, and then the collected edition in 1623, which is slightly different again. And we could spend a whole series of podcasts on those differences. But a hotspot that's been is really, really interesting to look at is To Be or Not to Be, which in the first quarto, in the 1603 quarto, is a much more comfortable sense that we are all waiting to go to heaven and that in the end, things will be okay. Whereas To Be or Not to Be as we have it now, as it comes broadly from that second quarto, is a much more fretful sense about uncertainties. And I think the scholarship which suggests that between those two versions, Shakespeare has read Montaigne, has read John Florio's translation of Montaigne, probably in advanced preprint copy, and has been completely blown away by the prose form of Montaigne's capturing of thought and of uncertainty, and that this has been transforming. And that may be actually, to think back to Alice's question about revenge tragedy, that might be the single thing that transforms Shakespeare's Hamlet from broadly a revenge tragedy character to a modern, reflective, interior protagonist.
And hence your point about the historical structure being just a framework on which you can then consider these existential points where both Shakespeare and Montaigne, and, you know, that sounds pretty convincing to me, embrace skepticism, they embrace doubt, and they embrace the human individual. Because I think it was Hume who, you know, talked about, I think he was talking about Hamlet when he said something like, we never really advance beyond ourselves. That's one of the messages of Hamlet.
And what Montaigne does constantly is relate the kind of general to the particular. And to do that, it's quite a sophisticated methodology. I mean, Montaigne's method is really important. He's constantly displaying his thought process. It's the whole point of the essays. He's continually, it almost doesn't matter what some of the things he's saying are. It's about the method. And if we think about when Hamlet says to be or not to be, now that is it's a quite banal philosophical question. It's one that comes from the archaic Greeks, actually. You know, Parmenides of Elia's reaction to the first philosophy, where he says there's this enormous expansion in what the Greeks decide to understand about nature through their kind of cosmology, through lots of explorations of nature. And Parmenides is probably the first philosopher who looks at that and goes, well, we've explored a lot of stuff. We understand, you know, how the heavens work. We understand how space works. But where does thought come in? And that's where he contrasts being with not being, between what is thought and what is not. And there's this kind of sense of crisis in archaic philosophy at that point, which is taken up by Plato in extraordinarily vivid terms. But anyway, I'm being a bit pretentious again here, but there's an interesting parallel in the sense that I think Hamlet, he's a student, he's very, very bright, he's grappling with lots of new stuff. He's then confronted with this terrible, almost archaic story of his father dying, his uncle killing him, his mother remarrying to his uncle, all these very deep, nasty
It's also themes. Quite Freudian.
Very, you know, and he's suffering from what modern psychotherapists probably call misalignment. You know, but it's as if all these old themes start to percolate into his personality and he starts grappling with it. And I think that's where the heroic element of Hamlet comes from, is that you can tell he feels all these great currents of ideas, some that are some of the most ancient thoughts that human beings have had, and he uses them to grapple with this kind of miserable reality that he faces. And I think that's Montaigne, in a very different way, does that as well, where he's constantly using very old ideas and sort of comparing and contrasting and using it to trigger thought. And I mean, Hamlet's soliloquy, you know, what's he to Hecuba? I think that bit is exactly that. He's kind of struggling with thoughts, and then he comes to a new solution, the play's the thing. So, yeah, that's my little archaeology.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. I think the question of whether Hamlet is a brilliant thinker or is himself a kind of slightly pretentious student is a really interesting one. Mm. You know, there's been recent work, most prominently perhaps by Rodri Lewis, talking about a Hamlet who is perhaps less clever than he thinks he is, and we've all been a bit taken in by that. But I do think that the Montaigne influence turns the play to be more fully focused on Hamlet himself. Mm. You know, that phrase, Hamlet without the prince, is exactly the sort of epitome of that this is a play about a person and about a mind and about an experience of the world. Whereas perhaps the first version of the play, if that's what we think this 1603 quarto is a more political or, as it were, historical play. There's more interest in Fortinbras as the person who's going to take over. There's a bit more interest in the kingdom and the idea of Denmark itself. And as we get more into Hamlet's own psychology, just as he himself gets more into his own interior life, that falls away, the sense that he's a prince, that he has obligations or at least possibilities in a political sphere, that becomes less important. And we see that, don't we, all the way through the history of Hamlet, where Fortinbras has tended to be often cut entirely, so that we do end with the sort of tragic beauty of Hamlet's own The Rest Is Silence.
Yeah, and cutting Fortinbras cuts out one of the doubles from the play, because it's full of doubles, isn't it? There's double revenge, yeah. There's several parallel plots, as well as the play within the play, which also has another play within the play, The Dumb Show. But there are so many multiplying stories within Hamlet. I think Frank Kermode called Hamlet a bazaar. You know, you can find anything you want there. And I wonder whether that's part of it. There's kind of endless mirrors within the play.
Yeah, the mirroring is a really interesting image for that, isn't it? And often literalised, thinking about Branagh's film, he's looking into a mirror, to be or not to be, but the mirror is also a kind of, enables him to see that he is being observed. And we often get modern sort of quite surveillance culture-y Hamlets. That's quite a common context in which to place this play, in which only your interior thoughts can be truly private, because everything else is observed or overheard or policed in some way. And you're right that one could think about that bazaar as a plenitude and a fullness. There are also points where it becomes a lack of artistic control. I think it's hard to imagine actually anybody in playwriting 101 thinking, let's send Hamlet to England, let's have pirates, let's have him then come back. This feels like, just as Claudius doesn't really quite know what to do with him, sort of, nor does the play, and Act Four is a little bit adrift in narrative terms.
Yeah, and that's something that some critics have reacted very sort of almost aggressively about, you know, that it didn't follow particular kind of unities.
Yeah, there's definitely a long history of that from the Restoration onwards, isn't there? A sense that Shakespeare is not classical enough, and that that's why someone like Milton establishes an alternative value system, warbling his wood notes wild, is a sense that this is a poet of nature, human nature, the world around, of observation rather than learning. And that was a long-term kind of alternative to the charge of being not classical enough. But I'm not just thinking about the unities of time. I'm just thinking about even just a well-structured play, that having somebody go off stage to do something else and then having them come with a lot of narrative explication about where they've been, which has been simply to get them out of the picture for a while. That feels, there are two or three uses of pirates in Shakespeare's plays, and they always look a little bit like a kind of shrug of thinking, God, I mean, how am I going to get out of this? Let's have some pirates. I'm sorry that that's it. I can see that that seems heretical alongside everything that we're saying about how significant and weighty and resonant the play is. And I think both are true at the same time. I think it's possible to say that Shakespeare is not great at Act Four and to say that this is a brilliant play that we have not finished understanding and echoing with.
It's also possible to say that, for example, The Count of Monte Cristo has a deep, Dumas novel has incredibly resonant and deep story at its heart, which is why it's been endlessly adapted and recapitulated and redone. But the novel itself is full of sort of Shaggy Dog Story moments of, you know, there's an Italian carnival bit, which he's clearly written, or someone in his writing team has written, because there's a fashion for the carnival in Paris or something. I think what I'm getting at is Shakespeare wrote a lot. To what extent is Shakespeare responding to kind of commercial pressures? Where does Hamlet fit in with the kind of, well, his job, basically?
Yeah, I think it's really important to remember Shakespeare as a commercial writer in a commercial theatre. I don't think that's a way of demeaning or dismissing things. I think what is commercially successful tells us a huge amount about what audiences want, what they enjoy. So it's very historically granular in lots of ways. We can actually sometimes see what Hamlet does by seeing its impact on other plays. Interestingly, I mentioned Thomas Kyd's revenge play, The Spanish Tragedy, which is the great sort of Star Wars of the Elizabethan period. Everybody knows about it, and everybody can quote a couple of lines from it. In a way, even if they haven't seen it, it just is an absolute Elizabethan meme. But it undergoes, after Kyd's death at the end of the 16th century, a bit of revision and a bit of renovation to give it a new life in the theatre. And the renovations make it more interior, more focused on the experience and the expression of grief rather than on the bloodthirsty quest for revenge. And one way to understand that example outside Hamlet is it is the Hamlet effect changing what audiences enjoy. It's clear that Richard Burbage, Shakespeare's great tragic actor, with whom he is almost in a kind of partnership, I mean, these are plays written for particular actors, and Burbage in particular, it seems clear that Burbage was an absolute master at expressive acting, at weeping, you know, all of those kinds of forms of emotional stillness and focus, and that people really, really enjoyed watching that. They enjoyed the bravura performance of that, and the use of the play within the play sort of points to that, doesn't it? Points to how great actors can be, and that seems to resonate outwards to Hamlet itself. So I think there are definitely ways in which the play draws on the expectations and the appetites of Globe theatre audiences at the beginning of the 17th century.
And that's a real contrast, I think, there between Shakespeare and Milton that you talk about, because Shakespeare is a commercial playwright. That's what he does. He has to earn his keep. He will take from anywhere in order to do that, and does it with extraordinary skill. Whereas Milton, in the sense that Shakespeare is a humanist, it strikes me that Milton is a kind of anti-humanist. He excludes a great deal. And then what he includes is, as you say, the acceptable classical and biblical references that he pushes to the nth degree. But he's writing, I think, for a very specific audience, a very educated, very learned audience. It is formidably difficult to take in the references that something like Paradise Lost or Samson Agonistes. It's the exact opposite. And he's also writing with a political project in mind throughout, at least with the mature works. Whereas Shakespeare, and I suppose we're coming to the key question here, is unknowable as a person. And we've seen the attempt in Hamlet to know this person. We've seen endless attempts to interpret the figure. And yet he remains ungraspable.
Yes, and he has chosen a form in which the singular voice completely dissolves. You know, in order to write a play, in order to be a successful playwright, you have to, at the very least, activate alternative points of view and make them seem compelling and reasonable to their speakers. And there isn't a place in a play for really a sort of authorial voice. It's interesting that people have wanted to see in Hamlet's direction to the players, you know, don't saw the air, speak the speech trippingly, you know, clowns talk too much, wanted to see that as the voice of Shakespeare. And they've wanted to see that, I think, perhaps as a way of perhaps assuming that Shakespeare himself rather regretted that he had to work for the theatre. But I think Shakespeare loved the theatre. When it's closed right early in his career for the plague, and he writes Venus and Adonis and Lucrece, both with the patronage of the Earl of Southampton, which some biographies of Shakespeare would say was very financially lucrative. These are super successful works in print. As soon as the theatres reopen, even though he has no reputation as a playwright at that time, he leaves aside that kind of writing, that kind of public, and, you know, commits himself back to the theatre. So I think that's a really active and important choice for Shakespeare. And I think it is the space, the theatre and its popular audience is the enabling condition of the works. It's not a sort of despite that. That's what he does it for. I think the comparison with Milton is a really good one. Milton has a much clearer and smaller and better educated audience in mind for whom a particular intellectual position and then political position is possible. Shakespeare much less so.
And he loves actors. I mean, you see that in Shakespeare. You can see the love of the stage, the love of the grease paint. It's all there and it's genuine.
It's all there. And I think also it was a very early part of Shakespeare's speculative biography that he didn't act very much, that he was not particularly an actor, and that he became the full-time playwright. And that comes from a period when actors are not thought to be sort of socially or culturally or intellectually of a very high status. And clearing Shakespeare of the taint of being an actor was quite important. That sort of hovered over us since, and you still hear people saying, oh, was he the ghost in Hamlet? You know, was he Adam in As You Like It? These are entirely invented ideas. And we, in fact, know from the time that Hamlet is written that Shakespeare is listed among the actors in Ben Jonson's plays that are also being done by the Chamberlain's men. I think he was probably a much more participative actor in the company for much longer than the biographical history has tended to want to see. And there's a lot of wish fulfillment in biographies of Shakespeare. And you're absolutely right that Hamlet, which is the novel by Maggie O'Farrell, now a big film, drawing on Freud's own sense that the death of Shakespeare's son, Hamlet, in 1596, must have somehow been connected with this play, which bears a version of his name. I think these are attempts to turn the play into a more personal and a sort of authentic expression rather than a creative one. And that's because we are in an age now where authenticity in fiction or authenticity in writing is one of our most prized characteristics. If you write a memoir and it turns out not to be true, that's a scandal. Or if you write from a position that it is felt you don't have the lived experience to do, that too is scandalous. Now, that's not the creative world of Shakespeare. And if we were to look for a play about the death of the loved male twin and how you might use art to ameliorate that, I would look at a play very close to Hamlet in date, which is Twelfth Night, where we get exactly that scenario. The male twin looks as if he's dead. Everybody is grieving for him and he returns. It's a way of art recuperating what can't be done in life.
This is quite a horrible question to ask you, Emma, but as someone who's been immersed in the works of Shakespeare and speaks with great authority on the subject, do you get any sense of his ideology, his personal beliefs from your immersion in his works?
It's a really, really interesting question. And one way to answer it, which would be to slightly push the question away, so I'll do it self-consciously, is to say it depends which works you pick. So you could produce a Shakespeare who is a sort of proto-feminist, or you could produce a misogynist Shakespeare, depending on the data set of the work. I do think one thing that's interesting about Shakespeare, which does connect to his biography in some ways, which are a bit hard to sort of pin down quite what the connection is. If we look at somebody like Christopher Marlowe, Marlowe's plays are preoccupied with self-made men. Tamburlaine was a shepherd and becomes the sort of king of most of Asia. Dr. Faust, as we hear, was born of parents, base of stock. It's all about education and self-belief propelling you into new possibilities. Shakespeare is very, very suspicious of the self-made man. And I think to the extent that you could say his plays as a whole are quite small C conservative, quite hierarchical, quite a sense that the social status stays the same. If you think Twelfth Night is in my mind because of work on it, if you think about Twelfth Night, it's no problem that Viola dresses as a man and usurps male privilege and prerogative. The play doesn't seem to have any problem with that. In fact, it rather likes it. But when Malvolio, who is a senior servant, thinks he might marry his mistress, the play really sort of throws everything at that to knock him down. And I think that's a general point about Shakespeare's plays, that he is pro an existing hierarchy, and people who try to challenge that in social terms tend to get punished for it. Now, that's very difficult to put alongside the Shakespeare who has petitioned and bribed the College of Arms for a coat of arms, rather defensively with the Latin tag, not without right, for his father and for the Shakespeares, completely trumped up about, you know, something about coming with the Normans and all that stuff. So this is somebody who has themselves become a gentleman by means which he must know are absolutely bogus, but is very, very clear in the plays that is not a desirable or a possible route to self-advancement.
And he wouldn't be unusual at that point, indeed at any point, to be concerned, once established, with security, to be fearful of a time out of joint.
Absolutely. And whether the tag of being a gentleman helps with that kind of security, I don't know. But certainly we see a Shakespeare who is using the commercial success of his works to invest in, you know, big, expensive real estate in Stratford, new place in Stratford, and in other commercial land-related ventures. This is the boy's made good, and he, you know, needs to secure that. Yeah.
I wonder if there's another parallel, just to return to Montaigne, about that small C conservative tag put on Shakespeare, because that's a common misconception about Montaigne, that he's this kind of radical sceptic, and it's the way he's often read because of the massive influence of the French philosophes in the 18th century and the way they think about Montaigne and use him for their own purposes. This idea that he's this, you know, the sceptic who questions absolutely everything, and he's the first modern mind. But he isn't really. He accepts lots of elements of the kind of status quo Montaigne. He accepts lots of elements about the kind of existing religious order. Mm. But in a sense, that allows him, it sort of gives him the rhetorical space to be creative. You know, if you accept some things, and it allows you to expand on others. So I wonder how true that is of Hamlet's. As you say, it's not a play like some of Shakespeare's later plays, which are so, you know, if you watch Othello, you think this is a genius bit of compression. Everything is like unfolds like clockwork. Hamlet's completely different from that.
Yeah, that's such a good observation, that it's in a way to see both its philosophical amplitude and its a more positive way to see what I was suggesting was a kind of bagginess of construction. Yeah, that's a great point. I think it's certainly true that free thinking, as we might imagine it in a sort of 21st century way, is not really available to the thinkers of this time. There are habits of thought and habits of seeing the world which can't all be dismantled. It's just not possible to dismantle them all at once. And I think that you're absolutely right that Montaigne's a kind of overreading both of Hamlet and Montaigne as modern figures underestimates the extent to which they are caught still or supported by belief systems which would be recognisable to, you know, their parents' generation or their grandparents' generation. That's an interesting thing about the generational work in Hamlet that's often been seen as a being on the cusp of a new generation, perhaps the issues of Elizabeth's succession, but also looking back perhaps to a Catholic past, a pre-Reformation past, that the generation of Hamlet's father seems to be in some way Catholic. The ghost is in purgatory. Mm. Hamlet himself is at Wittenberg, so strongly associated with Luther and with reform of the church that it's hard not to see in some way. I mean, it's not an allegory of religious change, but it seems to lean on that to some extent to structure its temporal disjunctions.
And of course, you're quite right, Emma. You know, this is one of the most fearful, paranoid periods in all of English history.
Quite. I mean, the end of Elizabeth's reign is a period of extraordinary anxiety, lack of clarity about what will come, a sense that the change of ruler is bound to produce religious or social upheaval in one way or another, an increased sense that Catholicism is a threat. Yeah, a lot of ongoing war in Ireland. The end of Elizabeth's reign is really not pretty in lots of ways. And we can look back on it as happened relatively early in the 17th century as this golden age with the Virgin Queen and so on. It's not quite looking like that to people who are living in 1600 at the time of Hamlet.
Just before we round off, Emma, I've just got one more question. You talk about the kind of modern interest in biography and the truth of a work of literature or the relative truth value, and people are sort of more interested in that because of kind of wider concerns about what is authentic, what is real. On the one hand, do you think that kind of submerges the text? It kind of gets you further away from the actual thing itself, i.e. what we have, the text in the plays over the three folios. And the other thing is, in terms of actually thinking about the play, how could we work towards a kind of contemporary interpretation of Hamlet that frees us from some of those problems of biography, those kind of, in the end, kind of ineffable problems of biography? And I was just thinking just now about what is probably the most famous version of Hamlet in the modern era, which is The Lion King. But it's Hamlet where things go right for Hamlet. He does overcome this problem of the father-son relationship. He does become the kind of true king. It's slightly different when Simba's father, Mufasa, confronts him. He says, "Remember who you are," you know, rather than just sort of "remember me." "Remember who you are, remember." So it's a slightly different emphasis. And again, Mufasa says, "You are my son and the one true king." The ghost in Hamlet doesn't say anything like that. It's much more of a kind of negative proposition. So anyway, in real contemporary terms, what's a kind of creative reading of Hamlet that can be a bit more acceptable to us?
It's interesting that the sort of biographical reading reinforces the sense that Hamlet himself has, I think, that really the play is him and the other characters sort of whirl around and are subservient, you know, plot devices in order that he can be more Hamlet. And there's an analogy there with a biographical reading or biographical readings of the plays, that they have to distort the balance of a play in order to find an author figure. And that's why they've tended to focus on plays which already have a big main role, like, say, The Tempest. So you can do that again with Prospero. So I suppose maybe that's a way of thinking that something we've already touched on, the way in which alternative stories might be excavated from this rich bazaar, to use Kermode's word, which you brought in earlier, Alistair. I think that's one of the ways that the modern period has done that. I mean, one thing we have not spoken about at all, and implicitly we have pushed to the side, is the role of women as parts of the play, but women as consumers of the play. I mean, this has been quite a male lineage through Dryden, Johnson, Hume, Lawrence of Arabia, Lion King. Do you know what I mean? This feels like the sort of critical patrilinear descent which the play itself is so bound up with. So I think Ophelia has become a very interesting character.
We should do another podcast on Ophelia, I think.
Yeah, we should on Ophelia's in the modern age, that Ophelia's thinking about how you can give a bit more agency to Ophelia, what the work of Ophelia's madness has done culturally. And also Gertrude, who's a character I'm really, really interested in, because she's on stage such a lot of the time, but speaks very little. And I think for the actor, that's a really interesting position to be in, that you've got a lot of scope to inhabit a particular figure in the Danish court, but it's not all scripted, directly scripted for you. So I think that might be one way to do that. And it's one of the ways that Hamlet curiously sort of fails to do that, in that having established a world about women and women's agency, it nevertheless turns its focus towards the transformative genius of Shakespeare.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Emma. That was an absolutely fascinating discussion, and definitely keen to take you up on doing something about Ophelia and Gertrude, who is a brilliant character and has some of the best lines. I mean, think Hamlet has great lines. Well, Gertrude's got some wonderful bits. The description of Ophelia's death is, to come back to Virgil, is near Virgilian in quality. And she's played brilliantly in the RSC production from 2008 with David Tennant by Penny Downey. So, yeah, thanks, Emma. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.